Mr. President, on Monday, October the 29th, the Israel Defense Forces took security measures in the Sinai Peninsula in the exercise of Israel's inherent right of self-defense. The object of these operations is to eliminate the bases from which armed Egyptian units under the special care and authority of Colonel Nasser invade Israel's territory for purposes of murder, sabotage, and the creation of permanent insecurity to peaceful life. These are the only military activities for which the government of Israel is responsible. Stretching back far behind the events of this week lies the unique and somber story of a small people, subjected throughout all the years of its national existence to a furious, implacable, comprehensive campaign of hatred and siege, for which there is no parallel or precedent in the modern history of nations. Not for one single moment throughout the entire period of its modern national existence has Israel enjoyed that minimal physical security which the United Nations Charter confers on all member states and which all other member states have been able to command. We meet here within the auspices of the United Nations, a family of sovereign states organized in a system of mutual rights and obligations. Its basic premise is the principle of sovereign equality of all its members. Whatever rights are enjoyed by other members of this organization belong to Israel without addition or diminution. Whatever obligation any member state owes to another, Egypt owes to Israel and Israel to Egypt. If Egypt denies Israel the plenitude of its charter rights, then it inflicts a deep injury upon Israel, and its competence to invoke the charter against Israel is seriously compromised and reduced. What are the obligations which Egypt owes to Israel under the charter? Under the charter, Egypt is bound to practice tolerance and live together in peace with Israel as a good neighbor. Under the charter, Egypt is bound to unite her strength with Israel to maintain international peace and security. Under the charter, Egypt is bound to regard Israel as a state endowed with sovereignty equal to her own. Under the charter, Egypt is bound to respect the territorial integrity and the political independence of the State of Israel, and especially to refrain from the threat or use of force against that integrity and that independence. Under the charter, Egypt is bound in advance to accept and carry out the decisions of the Security Council whenever such decisions are made in favor of Israel as of any other state. To these broad obligations derived from the Charter, there must be added to Egypt's account other obligations of a more specific nature based on the Armistice Agreement of 1949. Under this agreement, Egypt is bound to respect the demarcation line between Israel and herself, to prevent any illegal crossings of that line, to abstain from the threat or use of force from its own side of the line against Israel's side, to regard the armistice agreement itself as a transitory measure leading to permanent peace, to respond at any time to Israel's request for a conference to develop the armistice agreement into a peace settlement or to amend and review its provisions, to abstain from any act of hostility or any act of blockade or belligerency. Is there any resemblance whatever between this list of obligations and of Egypt's actual conduct of her relations with Israel? Can anyone imagine that if Egypt had been willing to carry out this system of relations with Israel, we should have been assembled here on this tragic and solemn occasion? What we confront tonight is a point of explosion after 7 years of illicit belligerency. Belligerency is the key to the understanding of our problem tonight. Egypt has practiced belligerency against Israel by land, Egypt has practiced belligerence against Israel by sea. Egypt has established belligerency as the juridical basis of its relations with Israel. Egypt has held belligerency to be the spiritual and emotional mainspring of her conduct towards Israel. Out of this fourfold belligerency maintained by Egypt for 7 years, but with special vigor and intensity since the rise of the Nasser regime, is born the crisis which the Assembly of the United Nations confronts tonight. I would say a word to the General Assembly on each of these aspects of Egyptian belligerency. Belligerency by land took its origins in May 1948, on the very morrow of Israel's emergence to sovereignty. On that date, Egyptian forces, joined by the converging forces of other Arab armies, marched into the newly established independent sovereign state of Israel with the avowed aim of its destruction. Alas, the processes which now move so swiftly in Egypt's protection were much slower at that time, and it took us 8 weeks to secure from the organs of the United Nations the establishment of an effective and stable ceasefire. During that period, every home in Israel stood under the direct shadow of death and extinction. Our men, women, and children fell by their thousands while this wave of aggression threatened to convulse us. At the end of that year, negotiations were held under United Nations auspices, which led to the conclusion of the Rhodes Armistice Agreement. This agreement did not promise us an affirmative, trustful, and cooperative pattern of relationships. It did at least, however, promise us immunity from overtly hostile acts. Under the Armistice Agreement, every citizen of Israel is entitled to till every inch of Israel's soil and to navigate every inch of Israel's waters without let or hindrance by any violent encroachment from the Egyptian side. Yet throughout this period of the armistice, our territory has been subjected to constant encroachments. The frontier has not been for Israel a barrier against the sudden leaping forward of violence by day and by night. Our toll of over 400 dead or wounded through these incursions tells the story of an armistice frontier which has been violated with consistency and with special frequency and intensity during the past 2 years, during which the Nasser regime has held sway in Egypt. The toll of dead and wounded has been augmented and aggravated by countless pipelines blown up, by water supplies demolished, by trees pulled down, by an inferno of insecurity and danger which has raged along peaceful farms and homesteads in the frontier area. And last year, as I shall point out, to all of these torments was added perhaps the most penetrating and perilous of all through the organization and mobilization of the Fedayeen movement. It might be difficult for nations assembled here which enjoy a normal security position to understand what has been involved for Israel by this belligerency on land. While much has been said about Israel's responsibilities to the United Nations, it is a melancholy fact that since 1948, any Arab state which has ever tried to kill Israelis, to plunder Israel property, to blockade Israel's ports, to intercept Israel's navigation, has never regarded itself as operating under any effective international deterrent. Thus, the United Nations has not been able to offer Israel the minimal daily security enjoyed by all its other members in nearly every sector of their national lives. Surrounded by hostile armies on all its land frontiers, subjected by savage and relentless hostility, exposed to penetrations, raids, and assaults by day and by night, suffering constant toll of life amongst its citizenry, bombarded by threats of neighboring governments to accompany its extinction by armed force, overshadowed by a new menace of irresponsible rearmament, embattled blockade besieged, Israel alone amongst the nations faces the battle for its security anew with every rising dawn and with every approaching nightfall. In a country of small area and intricate configuration, the proximity of enemy guns is a constant and haunting theme. These are the fears and provocations which hover over us everywhere. But they fall upon us with special intensity in the frontier areas, where development projects vital to the nation's destiny can be paralyzed or interrupted by our adversaries from a position of dominating geographical advantage. In short, it is a small country where every activity of farmers or citizens becomes a test of physical and moral courage. These are the unique circumstances in which Israel pursues its quest for security and peace. On innumerable occasions, the active defense of Israeli life and territory has been compromised in deference to international opinion. We know that Israel is most popular when it does not hit back, and world opinion is profoundly important to us. So on one occasion after another, we have buried our dead, tended our wounded, clenched our teeth in suppressed resentment, and hope that this very moderation will deter a repetition of the offense. But sometimes the right and duty of self-preservation, the need to avoid expanding encroachments, the sentiment that if the claim to peaceful existence is not defended, it will be forever lost, prevails in the final and reluctant decision. But this belligerency which assails us by land has its counterpart by sea. In 1948, the government of Egypt established processes of visit, search, and seizure, began to confiscate ships and cargoes bound for Israeli ports, established restrictive regulations, assumed punitive measures against the shipping and flags of other countries desiring to trade and to navigate peacefully with Israel upon and between the high seas. The flags of 15 nations, endowed with the unconditional right of free navigation in the Suez Canal, have been abused and prejudiced by unlawful acts of interception. Ships have been confiscated and sold. Cargoes have been held and sequestered. Sailors have been tormented and wrongfully imprisoned. And all of this on the great international waterway, consecrated 9 decades ago to the universal right of all nations for free commerce and navigation. Thus, classic acts of war by maritime blockade have been added to the pattern of Egypt's land belligerency in the total pattern of Israel's siege. Again, through all the developments of this policy, during the Nasser regime, we have witnessed a consequent sequence of aggravation. The processes of blockade and interception have been extended in the name of belligerency from the Suez Canal to another international waterway, the Gulf of Aqaba. And thus the state of Israel has had to distort the entire pattern of its economy to bear illicit burdens running into tens of millions of pounds in order to compensate for the impact of this piratical system which Egypt has established at this great artery of the world's communications. Belligerency by land and belligerency by sea are both expressed in a doctrine of juridical belligerency. This doctrine has been discredited by the Security Council of the United Nations, but it continues to be maintained. On the 12th of June 1951, an Egyptian representative said, "We exercise our rights of war. We are legally at war with Israel. This armistice does not put an end to a state of war. It will not prohibit Egypt from exercising certain rights of war." In the Security Council of the United Nations, the Foreign Minister of Egypt declared, "The Egyptian-Israeli General Armistice Agreement will not be interpreted by us as terminating in any legal or technical sense the state of war between Egypt and Israel." This jurisprudence continues to be maintained long after it has been adjudicated and discredited. It furnishes the basis for our contention that in juridical and legal terms, Egypt has cut itself off from its charter obligations towards Israel and does not even avow a legal basis upon which its conduct towards us can legitimately be explained. The fourth aspect of this belligerency should be studied in those statements of Egypt's intentions towards Israel, which furnish the philosophical background to the belligerent acts which I have described. Here is a typical example of the kind of utterance which bombards the ears of Israel's population by day and by night. "Wait and see," says the Egyptian dictator. "Soon will be proven to you the strength and the will of our nation. Egypt will teach you a lesson and quieten you forever. Egypt will grind you to the dust." On the 11th of April, celebrating the exploits of Egypt's commando units in Israel, the Egyptian Minister of Religious Properties declared, "There is no reason why the faithful Fedayeen, hating their enemies, should not penetrate into Israel and transform the lives of its citizens into a hell. Yes, we will be victorious because our motives are holy and our aims are the highest. We will be victorious because we are more diligent in death than is Israel in life." On the 14th of October, the Egyptian dictator himself said, "I am not solely fighting against Israel. My task is to deliver the Arab world from destruction through Israel's intrigue, which has its roots abroad. Our hatred is very strong. There is no sense in talking about peace with Israel. There is not even the smallest place for negotiations." The press, all the agencies and media of information take up the chorus. A typical example is in the leading Egyptian newspaper, "Israel will not be saved from the Arabs. She will be destroyed under the feet of Arab fighters, and the flag of freedom will be unfurled over Palestine." There is a tendency in some quarters to underestimate the importance and the impact of these pronouncements. I can assure members of the General Assembly that it is a unique and disquieting experience to live in a country surrounded by neighbors which bombard you by day and by night with predictions and menaces for your physical destruction. There is no doubt whatever that these authoritative directives furnish the psychological and emotional background against which belligerency by land and by sea is organized with growing and increasingly explosive intensity. But all of these aspects of belligerency together would not of themselves automatically invite a drastic response in self-defense. And I wish to explain frankly and candidly to the Security Council the special background against which our action of last Monday took place. World opinion naturally asks itself, what are these Fedayeen units? What their activities imply for Israel's security? Whether their actions in the past and their plans for the future are really full of peril for our country? Whether the peril was really so acute that Israel might reasonably regard its elimination as a primary condition of its security and indeed of its very existence? The government of Israel represents a people endowed with a mature understanding of international facts. We are not unaware of the limits of our strength. We are perhaps amongst the half dozen smallest members of this organization. We fully understand how certain measures might at first sight evoke a lack of comprehension, even in friendly minds. Being a democracy, we work under the natural restraints of a public opinion, which compels us to weigh drastic choices with care and without undue precipitation. It is, in short, a government which determines its actions by its single exclusive aim of ensuring life and security for the people whom it represents, while safeguarding the honor and trust of millions linked to it by the strongest ties of fraternity. Now, in recent days, this government of Israel had to face a tormenting question. Do its obligations under the United Nations Charter require us to resign ourselves to the existence of uninterrupted activity to the south and north and east, of armed units practicing open warfare against us, and working from their bases in the Sinai Peninsula and elsewhere, for the maintenance of carefully regulated invasions of our homes, our lands, and our very lives? Or, on the other hand, are we acting legitimately within our inherent right of self-defense, when, having found no other remedy for over 2 years, we cross the frontier against those who have no scruple in crossing the frontier against us? Members of the General Assembly may be in a better position to evaluate the choice and to identify themselves with this situation if they hear something of the background of this movement and its place in the total pattern of Egyptian intransigence and aggression. Let it be plain that the system of waging war against Israel by commando penetrations is the product of Colonel Nasser's mind. It is one of his contributions to the international life and morality of our times. After intensive preparation during the spring and the summer of 1955, this new weapon was launched in August of that year, breaking a period of relative tranquility on the Egyptian-Israeli frontier. Indeed, coming at a time when Egypt and Israel were engaged in hopeful negotiations with the United Nations Chief of Staff, looking towards the integral implementation of the 1949 Armistice Agreement. Between the 30th of August and the 2nd of September last year, the Egyptian government proclaimed its official responsibility for these invasions. On the 30th of August, it broadcast, "Egyptian forces have penetrated into the territory of occupied Palestine and pursued the attackers." On the 31st of August, 1955, an official communique informed the Egyptian people of this new military technique. "Egypt has decided to dispatch her heroes, the disciples of Pharaoh and the sons of Islam, and they will cleanse the land of Palestine. Thus we have decided, and thus is our belief, there will be no peace on Israel's border, because we demand vengeance, and vengeance is Israel's death."